by the bed. She did so with strange sensations. She was afraid that the big wooden doors of the bed would swing quietly too, and shut her up forever. She was afraid that the man who had brought her here, for all his air of niceness and kind eyes, had some evil design, that as soon as she went off to sleep, he would crawl into the room with a knife or a whip, or merely creep into the room. From these fears, her attention would be turned by the pattern of the tattered silk hangings on the bed, by the gold tassel of the bell pull, by the feel of the clean sheets under her fingers, by the beautiful curves of the bronze candlestick on the three-legged wicker table by the bed, from which candlestick guttered the single light standing between her and darkness. A light which by now should have been put out, and which would very soon go out of its own accord. She stared into the dark chasm of the fireplace, and began to fancy that something horrible might at any moment come down the chimney and plop into the hearth. She looked at the pair of old bellows, at the two strange painted ornaments on the mantelpiece. One looked like the Virgin Mary, and at the engraved cutlass above the door. In the dark corner beside the bed was a portrait, but she had not looked at it while the fat lady was in the room, and since the fat lady had left, she had not dared to move out of the circle of the candlelight. Time passed, and the candle was flaring up before it went out, sending smoky curls like wisps of an old woman's hair spiraling towards the beams. There were two doors, and that which led she didn't know where held a special danger, although it was tight shut every time she craned to look. Something scratched at the window. She listened, with her heart thumping. Then suddenly she caught something familiar in the noise, and she jumped from the bed and flew to the window. Minutes passed before she saw how to open it. Then, when a 6-inch gap had been slowly levered at the bottom, a wriggling black thing squirmed into the room, and she had her arms round Garrick's neck, half strangling him from love and anxiety that he should not bark. Garrick's nearness changed the whole picture for her. With his long rough tongue he licked her cheeks and ears, while she carried him towards the bed. The flame of the candle gave a preliminary lurch, and then straightened for a few seconds more. Hurriedly, she pulled across the hearthrug and another rug from near the door, and with these made on the floor an improvised bed for herself and the puppy. Then, as the light slowly died from the room, and one object after another faded into the shadows, she lay down and curled herself up with the dog, and felt his own excited struggles relax as she whispered endearments in his ear. Darkness came, and silence fell, and Demelza and Garrick slept. Ross slept heavily, which was not surprising, as he had no sleep the night before, but a number of odd and vivid dreams came to disturb him. He woke early, and lay in bed for a time looking out at the bright, windy morning, and thinking over the events of the past 2 days. The ball and the gaunt, wild Margaret. The aristocratic commonplace, and the disreputable commonplace. But neither had been quite ordinary for him. Elizabeth had seen to that. Margaret had seen to that. Then the fair, and its outcome. It occurred to him this morning that his adoption of yesterday might have troublesome results. His knowledge of the law was vague, and his attitude towards it faintly contemptuous. But he had an idea that one could not take a girl of 13 away from her home without so much as a by your leave to her father. He thought he would ride over and see his uncle. Charles had been a magistrate for over 30 years, so there was a chance he would have some views worth hearing. Ross also gave more than a thought to the violent court being paid to Verity by Captain Andrew Blamey. After the first, they had danced every dance together up to the time of his leaving the ballroom. Everyone would soon be talking, and he wondered why Blamey had not been to see Charles before now. The sun was high when he rode over to Trenwith. The air was exhilaratingly fresh and alive this morning, and all the colouring of the countryside was in washed, pastel shades. Even the desolate area around Grambler was not unsightly, after the greater desolation he had seen yesterday. As he came in sight of the house, he reflected again upon the inevitable failure of his father to build anything to rival the mellow Tudor comeliness of this old home. The building was not large, but gave an impression of space, and of having been put up when money was free and labour cheap. It was built in a square about a compact courtyard, with the big hall and its gallery and stairs facing you as you entered, with the large parlour and library leading off on the right, and the withdrawing room and small winter parlour on the left. The kitchens and buttery being behind and forming the fourth side of the square. The house was in good repair for its age, having been built by Geoffrey Trenwith in 1509. No servant came out to take the mare, so he tethered her to a tree and knocked on the door with his riding whip. This was the official entrance, but the family more often used the smaller door at the side, and he was about to walk round to that when Mrs. Tabb appeared and bobbed respectfully.
"Morning, sir. Mr. Francis you're wanting, is it?"
"No, my uncle."
"Well, sir, I'm sorry, but they're both over to Grambler. Captain Henshaw came over this morning, and they both walked back with him. Will he come in, sir, while I ask how long they'll be?"
He entered the hall, and Mrs. Tabb hurried off to find Verity. He stood a minute, staring at the patterns made by the sun as it fell through the long, narrow, mullioned windows. Then he walked towards the stairs, where he had stood on the day of Elizabeth's wedding. No crowd of bedecked people today. No raucous cockfight. No chattering clergymen. He preferred it this way. The long table was empty, except for its row of candlesticks. On the table in the alcove beside the stairs stood the big, brass-bound family Bible, now seldom used except by Aunt Agatha in her pious moments. He wondered if Francis's marriage had yet been entered there, as all the others had for 200 years. He stared up at the row of portraits on the wall beside the stairs. There were others about the hall, and many more in the gallery above. He would have had difficulty in picking out more than a dozen by name. Most of the early ones were Trenwith's, and even some later portraits were unnamed and undated. A small faded painting in the alcove with the Bible, where it should not get too much light, was that of the founder of the male side of the family, one Robert Darquet, who had come to England in 1572. The oil paint had cracked, and little was to be distinguished except the narrow, ascetic face, the long nose, and the hunched shoulder. There was then discreet silence for 3 generations, until one came to an attractive painting by Kneller of Anna Maria Trenwith, and another by the same artist of Charles Vivian Ralph Poldark, whom she had married in 1696. Anna Maria was the beauty of the collection, with large dark blue eyes and fine red-gold hair. Well, Elizabeth would be a worthy addition, would grace the company if someone would be found to do justice to her. Opie might be too fond of the dark pigments. He heard a door shut and a footstep. He turned, expecting Verity, and found Elizabeth.
"Good morning, Ross," she smiled. "Verity is in Saul. She always goes on a Wednesday morning. Francis and his father are at the mine. Aunt Agatha is in bed with the gout."
"Oh, yes," he said woodenly. "I had forgotten. No matter."
"I am in the parlour," she said. "If you would care to keep me company a few minutes."
He followed her slowly towards the parlour door. They entered, and she sat down at the spinning wheel, but did not resume what she had been doing. She smiled again.
We see so little of you. Tell me how you enjoyed the ball.
He took a seat and looked at her. She was pale this morning, and her simple dress of striped dimity emphasized her youth. She was a little girl, with all the appeal of a woman. Beautiful and fragile and composed. A married woman. A black desire rose in him to smash the composure. He subdued it.
We were so pleased that you were there, she went on. But even then you danced so little that we hardly saw you.
I had other business.
We had no intention of being there, she said,
a little put out at the grimness of his tone.
It was quite on impulse that we went.
What time will Francis and Charles be back? He asked.
Not yet, I'm afraid. Did you see how George Warleggan enjoyed the Écossaise? He had sworn all along that nothing would persuade him to attempt it.
I don't remember the pleasure.
Did you wish to see Francis on something of importance?
Not Francis. My uncle. No, it can wait. There was silence.
Verity said you were going to Redruth Fair yesterday. Did you get all the stock you wanted?
Some of it. It was on a question of unexpected stock that I wished to see my uncle. She looked down at the spinning wheel.
Ross,
she said in a low voice. My coming here upsets you. She did not move. I'll meet them on the way back, he said, rising. She did not answer. Then she looked up, and her eyes were heavy with tears. She picked up the woolen thread she had been spinning, and the tears dropped on her hands. He sat down again, with a sensation as if he was falling off a cliff. Talking to save himself, he said, At the fair yesterday, I picked up a girl, a child. She had been ill-treated by her father. I needed someone to help Prudy in the house. She was afraid to go home. I brought her back to Nampara. I shall keep her as a kitchen maid. I don't know the law of the matter.
Elizabeth, why are you crying?
She said.
How old is the girl?
13.
I should send her back. It would be safer, even if you had her father's permission. You know how hard people are judged.
I shall not come here again, Ross said. I upset you, to no purpose. She said,
It's not your coming.
What am I to think, then?
It only hurts me to feel that you hate me.
He twisted his riding crop round and round.
You know I don't hate you. Good God, you should know that...
She broke the thread.
Since I met you, he said, I've had no eyes... and no thought for any other girl. When I was away, nothing mattered about my coming back but this. If there was one thing I was sure of, it wasn't what I'd been taught by anyone else to believe. Not what I learnt from other people was the truth, but the truth that I felt in myself, about you.
Don't say any more. She had gone very white. But for once her frailness did not stop him. It had to come out now. It isn't very pretty to have been made a fool of by one's own feelings, he said. To take childish promises and build a castle out of them. And yet, even now sometimes I can't believe that all the things we said to each other were so trivial or so immature. Are you sure you felt so little for me as you pretend? Do you remember that day in your father's garden when you slipped away from them and met me in the summer house? That day you said,
You forget yourself, she whispered, forcing the words out.
Oh, no, I don't. I remember you. All the conflicting feeling inside her suddenly found an outlet. The mixed motives for asking him in. The liking, the affection, the feminine curiosity, the piqued pride. They suddenly merged into indignation. to keep out something stronger. She was as much alarmed at her own feelings as indignant with him. But the situation had to be saved somehow. She said,
"I was wrong to ask you to stay. It was because I wanted your friendship, nothing more."
"I think you must have your feelings under a very good control. You turn them about and face them the way you want them to be. I wish I could do that. What's the secret?"
Trembling, she left the spinning wheel and went to the door. "I'm married," she said. "It isn't fair to Francis to speak as we are doing. I'd hoped that we could still be good neighbours and good friends. We live so close, could help each other. But you can forget nothing and forgive nothing. Perhaps I'm expecting too much. I don't know. But Ross, ours was a boy and girl attachment. I was very fond of you and still am. But you went away and I met Francis, and with Francis it was different. I loved him. I'd grown up. We were not children, but grown people. Then came the word that you were dead. And when you came back, I was so happy and so very sorry that I'd not been able to keep faith with you. If there'd been any way of making it up to you, I'd gladly have done it. I wished that we still should be close friends, and thought, until today, I thought that we could. But after this, it's better that we shouldn't be." He came up to the door and put his hand on it. Her eyes were dry enough now, and exceptionally dark. "For some time," she said, "this is goodbye."
"It's goodbye."
He bent and kissed her hand. She shrank from his touch, as if he was unclean. He thought he had become repulsive to her. She went with him to the front door, where Darkie whinnied at the sight of him. "Try to understand," Elizabeth said. "I love Francis and married him. If you could forget me, it would be better. There's no more I can say than that."
He mounted the mare and looked down at her. "Yes," he agreed. "There's no more to say." He saluted and rode away, leaving her standing in the dark of the doorway.
Chapter 8. Well, he told himself, that was over. The subject was closed. If that queer, perverted pleasure which came from striking with his barbed tongue at her composure, if that was satisfaction, then he had found some in the interview. But all he felt was an ashen desolation, an emptiness, a contempt for himself. He had behaved badly. It was so easy to play the jilted lover, the bitter and sarcastic bore. And even if he had upset her by his attack, yet her defence had more than levelled the score. Indeed, their positions being what they were, she could, in a single sentence, strike more surely at him than he at her with all the ingenuity his hurt could devise. He was past Grambler, and nearly home before he realized he had not seen either Charles or Verity. And the two questions he had gone to Trenwith to ask remained unanswered. He rode down the valley, too full of a deadly inertia of spirit to find satisfaction in the sight of his land, which was at last beginning to show signs of the attention it was receiving. On the skyline near Wheel Grace, he could see Judd and the boy Carter busy with the 6 yoked oxen. At present, they were not used to working as a team, but in a week or so, a child would be able to drive them. At the door of Nampara, he climbed wearily down from his horse and stared at Prudy, who was waiting for him.
"Well, what is it?" he said.
"There's 3 men to see ye. They stank into the house without so much as a by your leave. They're in the parlour.
Uninterested, Ross nodded and entered the living room. Three working men were standing there, big and square-shouldered and stolid. From their clothes, he could tell they were miners.
"Mr. Poldark?"
The eldest spoke.
There was no seemly deference in his tone.
He was about 35, a powerfully built, deep-chested man with bloodshot eyes and a heavy beard.
"What can I do for you?" Ross asked, impatiently. He was in no mood to receive a delegation.
"Name of Carn," said the man. "Tom Carn. These my two brothers."
"Well?" said Ross. And then after he had spoken, the name stirred in his memory. So the matter was to resolve itself without Charles's advice.
"I hear tell you've gotten my daughter."
"Who told you that?"
"The widow Richard said you took her home."
"I don't know the woman."
Carn shifted restlessly and blinked his eyes. He had no intention of being sidetracked.
"Where's my daughter?"
he said grimly.
"They've searched the house,"
came from Prudy at the door.
"Hold your noise, woman," said Carn.
"By what right do you come here and talk to my servant like that?"
Ross asked, with malignant politeness.
"Right, by God! You slock my daughter! You ticed her away! Where is she?"
"I have no idea."
Carn thrust out his bottom lip.
"Then you best find out." "Aye," said one of the brothers.
"So that you may take her home and beat her?"
"I do what I choose with me own," said Carn.
"Her back is already inflamed."
"What right are you to be seeing her back? I'll have the law on you."
"The law says a girl may choose her own home when she is 14.
"She's not 14.
"Can you prove it?"
Carn tightened his belt.
"Look here, man. 'Tedn't for me to prove nothing. She's my daughter, and she'll not go to be plaything to a rake-hell dandy. Not now, nor when she's 40, see?"
"Even that," said Ross, "might be better than caring for your pigsty."
Carn glanced at his brothers.
"He ain't gonna give her up." "We can make him,"
said the second brother, a man of about 30 with a pockmarked face.
"I'll go fetch Judd,"
said Prudy from the door, and went out flapping in her slippers.
"Well, mister," said Carn, "what's it to be?"
"So that's why you brought your family," said Ross. "Without the spunk to do a job yourself."
"I could have brought 200 men, mister."
Carn thrust his face forward.
"We don't hold with cradle thieves down in Luggan way. Scatten up, boys."
Immediately, the other two turned. One kicked over a chair, the other upended the table, on which were some cups and plates. Carn picked up a candlestick and dashed it on the floor. Ross walked across the room and took down from the wall one of a pair of French dueling pistols. This he began to prime.
"I'll shoot the next man who touches furniture in this room," he said.
There was a moment's pause. The three men stopped, plainly thwarted.
"Where's my daughter?"
shouted Carn. Ross sat on the arm of a chair.
"Get off my land before I have you committed for trespass."
"We'd best go, Tom," said the youngest brother. "We can come back with the others." "'Tas my quarrel."
Carn plucked at his beard and stared obliquely at his opponent.
"Will ye buy the girl?"
"What do you want for her?"
Carn considered.
50 guineas.
50 guineas, by God!" shouted Ross. "I should want all 7 of your brats for that."
"Then what'll you give me for her?"
"A guinea a year, so long as she stays with me."
Carn spat on the floor. Ross stared at the spittle.
"A thrashing, then, if that's what you want?"
Carn sneered.
"'Tis easy to promise from behind a gun."
"'It is easy to threaten when it's 3-1.
"'Nay, they'll not interfere if I tell them no.
"'I prefer to wait until my men arrive.
"'Aye, I thought you would. "'Come us on, boys.'
"'Stay,' said Ross. "'It would give me pleasure to wring your neck. "'Take off your coat, you bastard!'
Khan peered at him narrowly, as if to decide whether he was in earnest.
"'Put down your gun, then.'
Ross laid it on the drawers. Khan showed his gums in a grin of satisfaction. He turned on his brothers with a growl.
"'Keep out of this, see? 'Tis my affair. I'll finish him.'
Ross took off his coat and waistcoat, pulled off his neckerchief and waited. This, he realized, was just what he wanted this morning. He wanted it more than anything in life. The man came at him, and at once, by his moves, it was plain that he was an expert wrestler. He sidled up, snatched Ross's right hand, and tried to trip him. Ross hit him in the chest and stepped aside.
"Keep your temper. Size him up first."
"I don't love you,"
Elizabeth had said. Well, that was straight. Discarded like a rusty ornament. Thrown aside. Women. Now badgered in your own parlour by a damned insolent red-eyed bully.
"Keep your temper."
He was coming again, and taking the same grip. This time, swiftly, with his head under Ross's arm. The other arm was round Ross's leg, and he was lifting. Famous throw. Fling your whole weight back, just in time. Side slip, and push his head up with a snap. Good. That was good. Break his damn neck. The hold slipped, tightened again. They both fell to the floor with a clatter. Khan tried to get his knee into Ross's stomach. Knuckles on his face. Twice. Free now. Roll over and on your feet. The second brother, breathing heavily, pulled the overturned table out of the way. Fight him afterwards. And the third. Khan, on his feet like a cat, grasped at the collar of Ross's shirt. The stuff held. They stumbled back against a tall cupboard, which rocked dangerously. Good Irish cloth was bad now. Mooning about an assembly ball, like a lovesick calf. Going off bleating at the sight of his mistress. Seeking the squalid. Stuff would not tear. Hand up and take the man's wrist. Left elbow violently down on Khan's forearm. The grip broke. A grunt of pain. Ross took a hold on the man's side. The other arm gripped his own right to increase the strength of it. Butted his head low. Khan tried to jab with his own right elbow. But they were too close together. In time, the miner kicked with his boots. But all the same, he was swung off the ground and flung 3 feet against the panelled wall of the room. Seeking the squalid, he had found the squalid. Drink and whores. God, what a solution. This was a better. Khan was on his feet again and rushed. 2 full punches did not stop him. He tackled Ross about the waist.
"Now you've gotten!" shouted the second brother.
Man's greatest strength was in his arms. He did not try to throw now, but ever tightened his hug and bent Ross back. He had injured a number of men this way. Ross grinned with pain, but his back was strong. After a moment, he bent no further at the waist, but at the knees, hands on Khan's chin. Toes just off the ground, as if kneeling on Khan's thighs. Solid straining. Black spots danced across the walls. Khan lost his balance, and they again crashed to the floor. But the grip did not relax. Letting blood of this drunken bully. Thrashing his own child till her back bled. Spots and blood. He'd get his lesson. Break the swine. Break him! Ross convulsively jerked his knees up, thrust sideways, was free. On his feet first, as Khan got up, he swung on him with the full weight of his body, to the side of the jaw. Khan went staggering back and collapsed into the fireplace amid a clatter of irons and kindling logs. A little slower getting up this time. Ross spat redly on the floor.
Come, man! You're not beat yet!
Beat? Said Khan. By a simpering young sucking bottle with a fancy mark on his face? Beat, did you say?
All right, growled Judd. I can't walk no faster. And what's to do when we get there? 'Tis only three again three then. And one of us is a slit of a boy, as thin as a stalk of weed and delicate as a lily.
Here, leave off, said Jim. I'll take my chance. Ye don't think to count me, Anne, said Prudy, rubbing her big red nose. There's no man born a woman I can't deal with if I've the mind. Puffed up pirouettes, that's what men are. Hit 'em across the head with a soup ladle, and what happens? They crawl away as if you'd hurt 'em.
I'll run on, said Jim Carter. He was carrying a leather whip, and he broke into a trot to take him down the hill.
"Where's the brat?"
Judd asked his wife.
"Dunno. They searched the house afore Cap'n Ross come home. A wonder to me ye didn't see him and come down. And I wonder ye didn't hear me just now when I was shouting, 'Horse, I am!"
"Can't be every place at once,"
said Judd, changing shoulders with his long pitchfork.
"'Tadn't to be expected of mortal man. If there was 46 Judd painters poodling about the farm, then maybe one of them would be in the right place to suit you. But there's only one, Lord be thanked.'
"'Amen,' said Prudy.
All right, then ye can't expect him to be within earshot every time you start crying out.'
"'No, but I don't expect him to be deaf on purpose, when I'm only one field away. The knees of your breeches was all I seen. But I knew 'twas you by the patches on 'em, and by the factory chimney puffin' smoke hard by.'
They saw Jim Carter emerge from among the apple trees and run across the garden to the house. They saw him reach it and enter. Prudy lost one of her flapping slippers and had to stop to retrieve it. It was Judd's turn to grumble. They reached the plantation of apple trees, but before they were through it, they met Jim Carter returning.
"'Tis all right. They're fighting fair. 'Tis a proper job to watch."
"What?"
snapped Judd.
"Wrestling? Here, have we missed it?"
He dropped his pitchfork, broke into a run, and reached the house ahead of the other two. The parlour was in ruin, but the best of the struggle was over. Ross was trying to get Tom Khan out through the door, and Khan, though too spent to do further harm, was yet fighting fanatically to save the ignominy of being thrown out. He was clinging partly to Ross and partly to the jam with a wicked, mulish will not to admit himself beaten. Ross caught sight of his servant and showed his teeth.
"Open the window, Judd!"
Judd moved to obey, but the youngest brother instantly stepped in his path.
"No, you don't. Fair's fair, leave him be."
With the respite, Khan abruptly showed more fight again, and took a wild grip of Ross's throat. Ross loosed his own hold and hit the man twice more. The miner's hands relaxed, and Ross swung him round, grasped him by the scruff of the neck and below the seat of the breeches. Then he half ran, half carried him through the door, across the hall, and out through the farther door, knocking Prudy aside as she panted upon the scene. The brothers waited uneasily, and Judd grinned at them knowingly. There was a splash, and after a few moments, Ross came back, gasping and wiping the blood from the cut on his cheek. He will call there. Now then. He glared at the other two. Which of you next? Neither of them moved. Judd?
Yes, sir.
Show these gentlemen off my property. Then come back and help Prudy to clear up this mess.
Yes, sir.
The second brother relaxed his tense attitude slowly and began to twist his cap. He seemed to be trying to say something.
Well,
he got out at last.
Brother's in the right, mister, and you be in the wrong, that's for sartin. But for all that, 'twas a handsome fight. Best fight ever I saw outside of a ring. Damn,
said the youngest, spitting.
Or inside of one. Many's the time he's laced me. I never thought to see him beat. Thank ye, mister.
They went out. Ross's body was beginning to ache with the crushing and straining it had had. His knuckles were badly cut, and he had sprained two fingers. Yet his general feeling was one of vigorous, exhausted satisfaction, as if the fight had drained ugly humours out of him. He had been blooded, as a physician blooded a man with fever.
"Oh, my dear," said Prudy, coming in. "Oh, I'll get ye rags and some turpentine."
"None of your doctoring," he said. "Doctor the furniture. Can you repair this chair? And here's some plates been broke. Where is the child, Prudy? You may tell her to come out now."
"Gracious knows where she's to. She seed her fader a-comin' and scuttled to me all of a brash. I have a mind she's somewhere in the house for all their searchin's."
She went to the door.
"'Tas all clear now, mate. Your fader's gone. We've drove un off. Come out wherever you be."
Silence. The cut on his cheek had almost stopped bleeding. He put on his waistcoat and coat again over his torn and sweaty shirt. Stuffed the neckerchief in a pocket. He would take a drink, and then when Judd came back to confirm that they were gone, he would go down and bathe in the sea. The salt would see that no harm came of the scratches and strains. He went to the big cupboard, which had rocked so perilously during the fight, and poured himself a stiff glass of brandy. He drank it off at a draught, and as his head went back, his eyes met those of Demelza Khan, very dark and distended, staring at him from the top shelf of the cupboard. He let out a roar of laughter that brought Prudy hurrying back into the room. Chapter 9. That night, about 9 o'clock, Jim Carter came back from visiting Ginny Martin. There had been some friendship between them before he came to work here, but it had ripened quickly during the winter. He would normally have gone straight to his stable loft to sleep until dawn, but he came to the house and insisted on seeing Ross. Judd, already in the know, followed him unbidden into the parlour.
"It's the Ilugan miners," the boy said, without preliminary. "Zacky Martin's heard tell from Will Nanfan that they're a-coming tonight to pay you back for stealing Tom Carne's girl."
Ross put down his glass, but kept a finger in his book. "Well, if they come, we can deal with them."
"I aren't so certain about that," said Judd. "When they're in ones and twos, you can deal with them, as we dealt with them today. But when they're in hundreds, they're like a great roaring dragon. Get acrossed off them, and they'll tear you to shreds as easy as scratch."
Ross considered. Shorn of its rhetoric, there was some truth in what Judd said. Law and order stood aside when a mob of miners ran amok. But it was unlikely that they would walk all this way on so small a matter. Unless they had been drinking. It was Easter week. "How many guns do we have in the house?"
3, I reckon."
"One should be enough. See that they're cleaned and ready. There's nothing more to do beyond that." They left him, and he heard them whispering their dissatisfaction outside the door. Well, what else was there to do? He had not seen that his casual adoption of a child for a kitchen wench would produce such results. But it was done now, and all hell should crackle before he retracted. 2 years abroad had led him to forget the parochial prejudices of his own people. To the tinners and the smallholders of the county, someone from 2 or 3 miles away was a foreigner. To take a child from her home to a house 10 miles away, a girl and underage, however gladly she might come, was enough to excite every form of passion and prejudice. He had given way to a humane impulse and was called an abductor. Well, let the dogs yap. He pulled the bell for Prudy. She shuffled in ponderously. Go to bed, Prudy, and see that the girl goes also, and tell Judd that I want him.
He's just went out just this minute. Went off with Jim Carter, the pair of 'em he did.
Never mind, then. He would soon be back, having probably gone no farther than to light the boy to his loft. Ross got up and went for his own gun. It was a French flintlock breechloader, one his father had bought in Cherbourg 10 years ago, and it showed greater reliability and accuracy than any other gun he had used. He broke the barrel and squinted up it, saw that the flint and hammer were working, put powder carefully in the flash pan, loaded the charge, and then set the gun on the window seat. There was no more to do, so he sat down to read again and refilled his glass. Time went on, and he grew impatient for Judd's return. There was little wind tonight, and the house was very silent. Now and then a rat moved behind the wainscoting. Occasionally, Tabitha Bethia, the mangy cat, mewed and stretched before the fire, or a billet of wood shifted and dropped away to ashes. At 10:30, he went to the door and peered up the valley. The night was cloudy, and out here the stream whispered and stirred. An owl flitted from a tree on furtive wings. He left the door open and went round the house to the stables. The sea was very dark. A long black swell was riding quietly in. Now and then, a wave would topple over and break in the silence with a crack like thunder, its white lip vivid in the dark. His ankle was very painful after the horseplay of this afternoon. His whole body was stiff, his back aching as if he had cracked a rib. He entered the stables and went up to the loft. Jim Carter was not there. He came down, patted Darkie, heard Garrick scuffle in the box they had made for him, returned the way he had come. Devil take Judd and his notions. He surely had sense enough not to leave the property after the boy's warning. Surely he had not ratted. Ross went into the downstairs bedroom. The box bed was empty tonight, for Demelza had been moved to her new quarters. He mounted the stairs and quietly opened the door of her bedroom. It was pitch dark, but he could hear a sharp, excited breath. She, at least, was here, but she was not asleep. In some manner, she had come to know of the danger. He did not speak, but went out again. From the room next door came a sound like a very old man cutting timber with a rusty saw, so he had no need to locate Prudy. Downstairs again, and an attempt to settle with his book. He did not drink any more. If Judd returned, they would take it in 2-hour watches through the night. If he did not, then the vigil must be kept single-handed. At 11:30, he finished the chapter, shut the book, and went to the door of the house again. The lilac tree moved its branches with an errant breeze, and then was still. Tabitha Bethia followed him out and rubbed her head in a companionate fashion against his boots. The stream was muttering its unending litany. From the clump of elms came the rough, thin churring of a nightjar. In the direction of Grambler, the moon was rising. But Grambler lay southwest, and the faint glow in the sky was not pale enough to reflect either a rising or a setting moon. Fire. He started from the house, and then checked himself. The defection of Judd and Carter meant that he alone was left to guard his property and the safety of the two women. If in truth the Alluggan miners were on the warpath, it would be anything but wise to leave the house unprotected. Assuming the fire to have some connection with these events, he would surely meet the miners if he went to look, and they were on their way here. But some might slip around and gain the house. Better to stay than risk its being set afire. He chewed his bottom lip and cursed Judd for a useless scoundrel. He'd teach him to rat at the first alarm. This desertion somehow loomed larger than all the neglect before he came home. He limped up as far as the long field behind the house, and from there fancied he could make out the flicker of the fire. He returned and thought of waking Prudy and telling her she must care for herself. But the house was as silent as ever, and dark, except for the yellow candlelight showing behind the curtains of the parlour. It seemed a pity to add needlessly to anyone's alarm. He wondered what the child's feelings were, sitting up there in the dark. Indecision was one of the things he most hated. After another 5 minutes, he cursed himself and snatched up his gun and set off hastily up the valley. Rain was wafting in his face as he reached the copse of fir trees beyond Wheel Maiden. At the other side, he stopped and stared across to Grambler. Three fires could be seen. So far as he could make out, they were not large, and he was thankful for that. Then he picked out two figures, climbing the rising ground towards him, one carrying a lantern. He waited. It was Jim Carter and Judd. They were talking together, Carter excited and breathless. Behind them, emerging out of the shadows, were four other men. Zachy Martin, Nick Vigus, Mark and Paul Daniel, all from the cottages at Mellin. As they came abreast of him, he stepped out.
"Why?"
said Judd, showing his gums in surprise.
"If 'tedn't Captain Ross, fancy you being hereabouts. I says to meself, not 5 minutes gone. Now I says, I reckon Captain Ross'll be just going off to sleep nice and piecemeal. He'll be just stretching his feet down in the bed. I thought I wish I was abed too. 'Stead of trampling through the misty wet, a mile from the nearest mug of toddy."
"Where have you been?"
"Why, only down to Grambler. We thought we'd go visit a kidley and pass an evening sociable."
The other men came up and paused, seeing Ross. Nick Vigus seemed disposed to linger, his sly face catching the light from the lantern and creasing into a grin. But Zachy Martin tugged at Vigus's sleeve.
"Come on, Nick. You'll not be up for your core in the morning. Good night, sir."
"Good night," said Ross, and watched them tramp past. He could see more lanterns about the fires now, and figures moving. "Well, Judd?"
"Them fires. Well, now, if ye want to hear all about un, 'twas like this."
"'Twas like this, sir,"
said Jim Carter, unable to hold his impatience.
"What with Will Nanfan saying he'd heard tell the Alluggan miners was coming to break up your house, on account of you taking Tom Carne's maid, we thought 'twould be a good thing if we could stop 'em. Will says there's about 100 of 'em carrying sticks and things. Well, now then, Grambler men owes the Alluggan men a thing or two since last Michaelmas fair. So I runs along to Grambler and rouses 'em and says to 'em,
"Who's telling this old yarn?"
Judd said with dignity. But in the excitement, Jim had lost his usual shyness.
"And says to him, 'What d'you think? Ilugan men are coming over here, bent on a spree.' Didn't need to say more than that, see? Half Grambler men was in the Kidleys, having a glass, and was fair dagging for a fight. While this, Judd runs down to Saul, and tells him same story. It didn't work so well there, but he comes back with 20 or 30.
36, said Judd.
But 7 of the skulks turned into Widow Tregothnan's Kidley, and still there for all I dunno, drowning in their guts. 'Twas Bob Mitchell's fault. If he...
They was just there in time to help build 3 bonfires.
3 bonfires, said Judd.
And then...
Let the boy tell his story, said Ross.
Well, now then, we builded 3 bonfires, said Carter, and they was just going pretty when we heard the Ilugan men coming, 4 or 5 scores of them, headed by Ramfrey Flamank, as drunk as a bee. When they come up, Mike Andrewarther mounts on the wall and belves out to him.
"What do you want, Ilugan men? What business have you here about, Ilugan men?"
And Ramfrey Flamank pulls open his shirt to show all the hair on his chest and says,
"What bloody concern be that o' yourn?" Then Paul Daniel says, "'Tis our concern, every man jack of us, for we don't want Ilugan men poking their nubbies about in our district." And a great growl goes up, like you was teasing a bear.
Jim Carter stopped a moment to get his breath.
Then a little man with a wart on his cheek the size of a plum shouts out,
"Our quarrel's not with you, friends. We've come to take back the Ilugan maid your fancy gentleman stole and teach him a lesson he won't forget, see? Our quarrel's not with you." Then Judd here belves out, "Who says there's aught amiss with hiring a maid like anyone else? And he took her in fair fight, you bastards, which is more than any of you could do back again. There never was an Ilugan man what—"
"All right, all right," interrupted Judd in sudden irritation. "I knows what I says, don't I? Think I can tell what I said meself."
In his annoyance, he turned his head and showed that one eye was going black.
"He says there never was an Ilugan man that wasn't the dirty cross-eyed son of an unmarried bitch with no chest and spavin shanks out of a knacker's yard. I thought 'twas as good as the preacher." And then someone hits him a clunk in the eye.
Ross said, "Then I suppose everyone started fighting."
"Nigh on 200 of us. Lors, 'twas a proper job. Did he see that great fellow with the one eye, Judd? Mark Daniel was lacing into him when Sam Rosscollar came up. And Ramfrey Flamank—"
"Quiet, boy," said Judd.
Jim at last subsided. They reached home in a silence which was only broken by his gurgling chuckle and the words,
"Ramfrey Flamank as drunk as a bee."
"Impudence," said Ross at the door. "To go off and involve yourselves in a brawl and leave me at home to look after the women. What do you think I am?" There was silence. "Understand, quarrels of my own making I'll settle in my own way."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, go on to bed. It's done now. But don't think I shall not remember it." Whether this was a threat of punishment or a promise of reward, Judd and his partner could not be sure, for the night was too dark to see the speaker's face. There was a catch in his voice, which might have been caused by a barely controlled anger. Or it might have been laughter, but they did not think of that.
Chapter 10. At the extreme eastern end of the Poldark land, about 0.5 mile from the house of Nampara, the property joined that of Mr. Horace Treneglas, whose house lay a couple of miles inland, behind the Hendrawna sand hills,
and was called Mingoose. At the point where the two estates met on the cliff edge was a third mine. Wheel Leisure had been worked in Joshua's day for surface tin, but not at all for copper. Ross had been over it during the winter, and the desire to restart at least one of the workings on his own land had, after consideration of Wheel Grace, come to centre upon this other mine. The advantages were that drainage could consist of adits running out to the cliff face, and that in some of the last samples taken from the mine and hoarded by Joshua, there were definite signs of copper. But it needed more capital than he could find. So on the Thursday morning of Easter week, he rode over to Mingoose. Mr. Treneglis was an elderly widower with three sons, the youngest in the Navy and the others devoted fox hunters. He was himself a scholar and unlikely to care for mining adventures. But since the mine was partly on his land, it was the smallest courtesy to approach him first.
"Seems to me you've got so little to go on. Almost like digging virgin ground. Why not start Wheel Grace where their shaft's already sunk?"
shouted Mr. Treneglis. He was a tall, heavily built man, whom deafness had made clumsy. He was sitting now on the edge of an armchair, his fat knees bent, his tight knee breeches stretched to a shinier tightness, his buttons under a strain, one hand stroking his knee and the other behind his ear. Ross gave his reasons for preferring Wheel Leisure.
"Well, my dear," shouted Mr. Treneglis, "it is all very convincing. I believe you. I have no objection to your making a few holes in my land. We did ought to be good neighbours."
He raised his voice.
"Financially now, I'm a bit costive this month. Those boys of mine and their hunters. Next month, perhaps I could loan you 50 guineas. We did ought to be good neighbours. How would that do?"
Ross thanked him and said that if the mine were started, he would run it on the cost book system, whereby each of a number of speculators took up one or more shares and paid towards the outlay.
"Yes, excellent notion,"
Mr. Treneglis thrust forward an ear.
"Well, come round and see me again, eh? Always glad to help, my boy. We did ought to be good neighbours, and I'm not averse to a little flatter. Perhaps we shall find another Grambler."
He rumbled with laughter and picked up his book.
"Perhaps we shall find another Grambler. Ever read the classics, my boy? Cure for many ills of the modern world. I often tried to get your father interested. How is he, by the way?"
Ross explained.
"Why, damn me, yes. A poor job. It was your uncle I was thinking of. It was his uncle I was thinking of,"
he added in an undertone. Ross rode home feeling that half a promise from Mr. Treneglis was as much as he could expect at this stage. It remained for him to get some professional advice. The man to approach for this was Captain Henshaw of Grambler. Jim Carter was working in one of his fields with the three young Martin children. As Ross passed, Carter ran over to him.
"I thought I'd tell you a bit of news, sir," he said quietly. "Reuben Clemo's runned away."
So much had happened since their meeting last Sunday that Ross had forgotten the last of the Clemos. The interview had not been a pleasant one. The man had been shifty but defiant. Ross had reasoned with him, trying to get at him through a blank wall of suspicion and resentment. But even while doing it, he had been conscious of failure and of the enmity towards himself, something that couldn't be met or turned by good advice or a friendly talk. It was too deeply rooted for that. "Where has he gone?"
"Dunno, sir. What you said to him about turning him out must have frightened him."
"You mean he isn't at the mine?"
"Not since Tuesday. Nobody's seen him since Tuesday."
"Oh, well," said Ross. "It will save trouble." Carter looked up at him. His high-boned young face was very pallid this morning.
Ginny to think he's still hanging around, sir.